Hello and welcome to Living Downstream. I'm Julie Lowe, the Environmental and Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Today I'm delighted to be speaking with Bruce Burry and Gwen Burry about the Western Pond Turtle. Welcome, Bruce and Gwen. Can you tell us more about yourselves?
Yeah, I'm Bruce Burry. I'm a retired. I used to work for the U.S. Geological Survey. Before that, it was the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but I've been retired for about 8 years. Been around, proudly say I'm a native Oregonian, and as one of my jokes, I was born in Roseburg, so I do have deep connections, but the joke is my mom grew up there. In fact, people go down to the park and look across. That's the grandparents had a farm right across from the Roseburg Park down by the North Fork. The joke is, when I was 2 weeks old, I was moved up to Portland. I was there for a while, and then family moved down to Eureka, California, on the Northwest Coast. Pretty much grew up in Northern California, but it's just right across the border. So I kind of had my roots in the area. Went to Humboldt State for an undergrad. I always liked the area. Later on, I went to Sacramento State for a master's, and then to University of California, Berkeley for my PhD. To get a permanent job, I had to finally move elsewhere, but I actually went to Washington, D.C. at the National Museum of Natural History for 5 years. Beautiful area, nice people, but not my cup of tea. I'm kind of a country bumpkin at heart. Slowly moved back west to Colorado, there for like 18 years. And then I got myself transferred. Now I'm back in Corvallis, Oregon, which I'm very pleased with. But I do have some connection. My dad worked at a timber company, so I do know a little bit about that.
All right, and I'm Gwen Burry. I'm Bruce's daughter. I was not born in the Pacific Northwest. We moved here, as Bruce said, when I was 14, and then I did my undergrad at Southern Oregon, my master's at Western Washington, and my PhD at Oregon State. And I'm currently a postdocing it around whoever will pay me. I've been working on turtles my entire life because Bruce's daughter. So this has been something that he's been interested in and been working on for many decades, and I've gotten to join in on the fun. That's us. Thanks very much for having us on.
I think that's fantastic. I'm loving the father-daughter thing. That's
Yep.
Yeah, it's
yeah.
pretty rare.
Yeah, I love it. You know, like many of us did, I spend every moment in nature with my dad. I love that. Those are the best days. So today we're talking about the Western Pond Turtle. I get this question. First of all, we have an audience of very new folks to the field, experts in the field. We have a whole range of expertise. Why do we care? Tell me about the Western Pond Turtle. Characterize it for me. And why have you focused on this turtle?
Let me try to summarize it. They're kind of a medium-sized turtle. They're kind of brown. Usually, lots of times people don't even see them, but if you look carefully, they're out and they're all around the Umpqua Basin. So they're a common, well-loved turtle. And as Gwen pointed out, everybody loves turtles, which is true. I mean, they're in mythology. Native tribes have connections to them. Even in mythology, there's lots of things about turtles. They're all. We all say they're slow but steady, tails like that, but they're charismatic, and we kind of naturally like them. One, most of them don't bite you. They're kind of docile looking and just sort of like going out doing their own thing out there. But that's important too for conservation things. This is a species that a lot of people like. So say the Western Pond Turtle ranges up from like Puget Sound area up in Washington down to northern Baja. But I call it the thin green line that kind of go way big range. That's actually an incredible range. North, south, east, west, though, they don't go that far. They're pretty much on this side of the Cascade Divide and same thing, the Sierra Nevada Divide. So they're kind of on the western slopes. In some ways, they're highly adaptable. They kind of, they live over this wide range. They can live in ponds, quiet water, streams. But at the other thing, they're kind of got a disjunct distribution, even like that. Like water is actually quite rare in the West. It's only like 1% or less of the landscape. But some of the conflicts we'll get into later is anywhere you got water, you got humans too. So that's one of the issues. They're there. They have kind of a little isolated population, is pretty common, or if they're along rivers, there'll be a few, but then they tend to concentrate. But it's a resident, and a lot of people know it.
So I would add on to what Bruce has said. One of the reasons that we study Western Pond Turtles is because they are so long-lived, and so you get kind of a record of what's been happening for decades and decades and decades in an area by looking at Western Pond Turtles.
That's a really good point.
Some of the reason that we work on Western pond turtles is because they are an animal that we can capture, mark, and then release and recapture again over decades of time. So that makes it really valuable scientifically. Although we are obviously much bigger than they are. If you think about a freshwater aquatic ecosystem, Western pond turtle is a relatively pretty big vertebrate predator. I mean, they're not as big as us, but we're pretty big compared to a lot of the things in the world. So they are a pretty large vertebrate in their ecology systems, ecological systems. But as far as human conflicts over water and the trade-offs between conservation and development and various other human uses of water, turtles are definitely on the front lines of those conflicts.
Well, when I think about conflicts, I think also about pollution. Are these turtles pollution sensitive, or are they pretty tolerant for that?
Well, it depends on what the pollution is. You know, sometimes like if there's an oil spill, they'll die. But in other cases, they're pretty resilient to a lot of things. You know, they live in places that I'm not sure I'd go into. And there's wastewater plants that have side pools and the turtles are in there.
Right.
And do well because there's lots of food. But on the other hand, there's a dangerous underlying thing here is that if you live in those waters, they're often high in toxic elements that build up. Then over time, the turtles might accumulate it and that might kill them in the long term. So it's kind of good today, but bad for you in the long term. And I think human health happens too. The accumulations that do happen. And a lot of the heavy metals might get in the turtles, but they're fairly resistant on the short term, but not so much on the long term.
One of the reasons for that is because they're air breathing. So things like toxic algal blooms will take out, like kill all the fish. But the turtles are like, well, I don't breathe the water. So we don't actually know the full effects of toxic algal blooms, because again, those can have sort of longer term effects. And they are eating other things in that water. So it may still affect them. But it certainly doesn't have those instantaneous like fish kills that you see. And we do still find Western pond turtles pretty close to agricultural areas. So we don't know if those we can mostly only look now, right, in pretty altered landscapes, but we do find fairly healthy populations in agricultural landscapes. So whatever's going on with fertilizers and pesticides at least doesn't seem to be immediately impacting them.
So then let's talk about their overall role in the ecosystem. You talk about them being as a predator. What is their role?
A long time ago, I did a study on their food habits, and they're an omnivore, but they do switch. I have to point that out first. The small turtles are mostly eat insects and live food, and almost 95% of their diet is like aquatic insects, anything they can get and put in their mouth. But they really like live moving food. But then the adults, when they get bigger, I don't know if they just run out or everything, but the adults tend to start feeding also on plant material like green algae. I mean, that filamentous green algae, or they'll eat about anything. You know, in fact, there's a couple of cases of them even eating carrion. Like somebody found a dead duck and there's turtles overfeeding on it. And they might feed on like dead lampreys. And they will eat fish and frogs when they can catch them, but it's so rare. You know, there still are turtles, you know, they're not pumas or anything fast. They can't. I mean, some people have asked me too that if they eat like salmonid fishes, they're not capable of catching any fish that's healthy. They might occasionally get one in a side pool that's drying up, but in that case, the fish are going to die anyhow. But in any flowing water or any pond, the turtles, they're not any threat to any kind of fish that's healthy. But, you know, they eat a lot of food, but at the same time, they do have to have food. So that's sometimes a limiting factor.
We have called the adult's diet the chef salad, because there are still those aquatic invertebrates that they're getting, especially later in the summer. You get big filamentous like algal mats, and they'll go take a big chomp out of one of those and get all kinds of bugs and shrimps and things. I will say that when we're using bait to attract them, that we use cat food or sardines. So they clearly do like those sort of
smells.
Fishy sort of smell things, dead meat smells. That's what we use as bait. So if they could get a fish, they would be very happy about that.
Right.
But they most of the time don't have the swimming ability to capture a salmonid. Salmonids are fast.
And one side one, but in fact, they're pretty remarkable. They just look kind of clunky and don't do anything, but they are social and they're more agile than you might think. And one example would be because I had one, I was in grad school and I decided to feed it some fairy shrimp, which swim around. So and they, people use that to feed their tropical fish, but I put them in there just as an experiment. And the turtle went around and would get up real close and they'd do it called gape and suck. It opened its mouth and drop the throat and just suck them right in and then stain the water out. But it could go through the water column and it could catch the shrimp. And that takes a lot of coordination. I mean, a lot of things can't do that. So if there's live food, they're going to go after it. But again, it's mainly insects. But again, it's this kind of dark black box out there. But no, they're actually have the ability to, you know, be pretty darn good at capturing prey. And then when I was growing up, we had a pet one and actually would feed it grasshoppers, but they'd be on land. So the turtle would come out of the water, grab the grasshopper and take it back. And to this day, we think they can only feed in water. And that is kind of a limiting factor because if the pond dries up, that's pretty much the end of their activity season for the year. So they do need water. That's one of the key elements here that they have to have. If they don't have water, you're not going to have pond turtles.
Yeah, I do understand that, actually. They do need water to swallow, basically. Is it true they don't have, do they do not have saliva? And so they need the water. What is that? What is that?
Well, no, that's just what you said. For some reason, you know, they don't seem able to eat on land. A relative of theirs is the wood turtle back east. They actually eat earthworms. Actually, they'll come out on land and they do a thumping with their feet. And the earthworms actually come up to the surface and the wood turtle will grab it and then eat it. But the wood turtle can feed on land, unlike box turtles back east. But from what we know, the western pond turtles can't eat on land. They have to go back to water.
But I don't think we know the physiological reason.
Yeah, we don't know.
We just never found any terrestrial prey in what they've eaten.
Right. But I guess they can smell. You did tell us that they can smell their prey or food.
Oh, no, they definitely can smell. And even in water, they, like we do, we use sardines as bait because they, that really makes a difference. A smelly, you know, fish, real strong fish is the best bait. And so they have a good sense of smell.
So that's a classic scavenger.
Yep.
So tell me what their ecological role is then in this area and let's say the Umpqua watershed.
Well, they're kind of like in between. They're both predator and prey. We've just sort of been talking about what they eat. So they're out there kind of like, you know, munching away on, usually in the shallows, eating insects and maybe ingesting some algae in the process. But then a lot of animals feed on them. And there's a big link here between they're in the water. So they're eating that, call that all the resources going into them. And then the females move to land. So in fact, they're taking resources from the water, going up to land and depositing their nests year after year. And then the eggs often are found by predators like skunks, coyotes,
raccoons.
Raccoons are just really hard on them. So they are, a lot of other animals along the riparian zone are eating turtle eggs. And when they hatch out, hatchlings have a very high mortality rate because most of the hatchlings are eaten up too. So those are the real sensitive or critical times for the turtle. But most of them, and up to about 4 or 5 years old, they're pretty vulnerable and they mostly hide. And one reason is if they're out, they're like Gwen jokes about, they're basically an Oreo cookie. Most anything can eat them. Including herons. We did do a little note on that. Herons will eat the hatchlings, a lot of birds, mammals. So everything's feeding on them and extremely high losses. You know, 90-95% of them are lost from them, egg, hatchling size. But all that's going into the food web.
Right.
And then the adults are, so they spend a long time growing big. Once they're adult size, they're tanks, right? They use a ton of energy to build themselves this big, sturdy shell. And we don't have a lot of predators currently in the Pacific Northwest who are able to eat them once they're adult size. We'll find adults that have clearly been like chewed on.
Right.
But they survived. And so bears can chew on them and occasionally kill them, but sometimes can't sort of crack them open.
Right.
Unfortunately, the thing that does eat them is otters, which everyone loves the otters, but we shake our fist at the otters when they come by because they'll eat a bunch of the turtles.
Yeah, and the river otters, too, are only able to pull off a leg or a head. And they actually don't eat most of the turtle. They can't get most of the meat out because the shell is still intact, but the arms and legs and heads are gone. And that you can tell from a river otter's hit them. And the otters can't, you know, really knock back the adults. But that shell is incredibly tough. And as you say, you can almost see, like, you know, it's chewed on by a big predator. And it seems to be like bears will chew on them, but seem unable to crack the shell. So once they get big, you know, but there is a cost to that. It takes a lot of energy to grow that thick shell, but that's the way of the turtle. You know, they put a big investment into their shell. And once they get to be an adult, they're pretty much, you know, they're not bulletproof, but they're, you know, armored.
And that also delays their reproduction by a really long time to do all of that shell building instead
right.
of reproduction.
And they're also a pretty tough species because, you know, when I was doing my, I actually did my dissertation on Western pond turtles, but about 5%, just roughly, of them were missing a leg. You look at it and have a stump, so something got the leg out, chewed their leg off, and then they probably got dropped back in the water. And I'm going, if that happened to us, we'd drop dead. You know, somebody cut your hand off and think you're living in these, you know, you're living in water. You think the bacteria would get in
right
there, but they somehow they can. But I've found some with like two legs missing, a front and a rear, and one that I was almost sad, really shouldn't say sad over, but there's one female that I found and she had both front legs chewed off. She had two stubs growing back, and I marked her and let her go. I'm like, what you gonna do, put her back in the water? But swam off in a straight line. So she adjusted. She was still getting down with both, you know, basically two nubbins up front.
Right.
Doing fine. And they're still, so they're pretty remarkable that way of being able to withstand that kind of injury. And they must have some kind of immune system that I've never seen anybody even look at it, but they're capable of, you know, getting a leg ripped off and no surgery, it's just an open wound, you know, and
right.
their body's repair.
You know, I've worked with turtles a bit, and I've read about them. One thing I hear, and you correct me if this is an old wives' tale, is that they don't age as far as they're, as in they don't die of old age. Like a newborn, his heart is basically as healthy as a grandpa turtle's heart as far as aging. Like humans, our heart shows aging. And the turtles, it really doesn't, pretty much. They can die of disease and being crushed and being eaten, but they don't necessarily die of old age, like their organs failing. Is that true?
So that depends. So not for all species.
Okay.
So Bruce, what are some examples of turtle species that have a shorter lifespan?
Yeah, well, some like, even out here, we have the red-eared slider that's introduced.
Yep.
Most of them rarely make it past age 25, and I don't know the reasons for that, but in their natural habitat, even, they grow fast, but they seem to die fast. I don't know why that is.
Okay.
Which the Western pond turtle, we have a record now. The record for the Western pond turtle, and it's a turtle I marked in 1968, and we recaptured it, and that was the highlight of my career, I think. At 2018, it was 50 years between captures, and
wow.
It was 5 years old when I marked it. So it was 55 years old, and we had a picture of it which is available. We get into that, but that female was just perfect. She had clear eyes, no blemishes, all and the nails wear down, but all her toenails weren't worn.
Right.
In fact, if I looked at it, I probably think it was like maybe 20 years old or something, but it was perfectly healthy as a turtle went. No signs of aging whatsoever. And it was 55 years old.
Yeah.
I'm a bit jealous because I'm a senior citizen. But they age. But also part of that is if you were a turtle, they're only active like 5% of the time. Most of the year, at least 6 months of the year, they're asleep, dug down in the mud or up on a hillside. But even during their activity season, they come out. They might spend 4 or 5 hours a day being active, maybe forage, go out, and they like to bask, and they're very good at regulating their body temperature. But then they go to sleep, and what they do, they're out. But then most of the time, they're hiding. They go down, and I assume they're just taking a nap, but you don't see them. But they're not moving around, so they're not using any resources. So that's one of the reasons maybe there's not any wear and tear on the heart is like
right.
Their heart's only going at a fast rate for 5%
right.
or maybe even less than that all year. They're basically, they don't do anything, but that's a kind of a thing on reptiles of, you know, be active and then go inactive, and that cuts down.
So this is me shifting back into I taught for too many years mode. So this is some advantages and disadvantages, like Bruce was talking about, with a lot of reptiles doing this.
Uh-huh.
Of being a homeotherm versus a poikilotherm. So an animal so we're a homeotherm. We keep our internal temperature at the same temperature all the time.
Great.
And we spend a huge amount of our calorie budget doing that. And it essentially wears everything out faster, right? Everything is going at cheetah speed absolutely all the time.
Mm-hmm.
In comparison to that, if you're looking at a big reptile, like a crocodile, for example, they can go up on a log and bask and heat everything up to, I mean, not quite cheetah speed, but like fast enough to leap on something.
Great.
Right. And then take that meal, go down in the bottom of the pond where it's really, really cold. That meal isn't even going to start to digest until they warm themselves up again.
Right. Okay.
Those calories, that like one meal's worth of calories could last them as long as a month.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
One where if we're looking at Mr. Cheetah over here, if Mr. Cheetah hasn't eaten in a couple of days, our bodies start dissolving we start eat ourselves because we need so many calories to keep up that internal body temperature.
Right.
So the things with like aging rates in something like a turtle is that you're looking at like an engine that's running continuously versus an engine that like starts up once a week.
That makes sense. Yep, that makes sense to me.
So we get a lot more wear and tear because we're like, we're running that engine absolutely all the time with the like heater blasting.
Right.
So
okay,
so
that makes sense.
Be a turtle. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing I heard somewhere is that, and don't quote my number, but something like 90% of turtles die as hatchlings or before they reach a year of age. Because of just predational. And after that, the mortality rate goes way down. Because once they get to a year or so, then they're good to go. They're a tank, like you said. And so is that about the average? Like how many make it to the first year, do you suppose?
Even higher mortality than that.
Oh, okay.
We're 95, above 95% mortality in the first year.
Yeah, it depends. No, that's it, mother. Very heavy predation or losses on the eggs and the hatchlings. That's, like you said, it's up there around 90% of each of those are probably don't make it. But on the other side, the reason turtles are here, though, is they also take a long time to build that shell.
Mm-hmm.
So have delayed reproduction. They're not like dogs, or like a year later they can start breeding, or king cat. Turtles, like here, the Western Ponderosa takes about 7 or 8 years before they reach sexual maturity, but they're building the shell. So they put all the growth is going into the shell and all the resources to build that armor. And until they get fairly good size, 4 or 5 inches long, they're not even reproductive, because, you know, once they get up around 6, 7 inches long, they're full adults. And that's when they really start cranking the eggs out. So up to then, they're pretty vulnerable. So it's very high mortality. But then once you're an adult, I mean, I was recapturing turtles, like 80% of the adults I marked, I'd recapture. And I don't catch all of them. I mean, I was doing real intensive survey. I mean, they go out of the study area and come back.
Right.
Once you're an adult, you're pretty much got a ticket to survive. But there's a little bit of, every year, there's a little bit of loss. I mean, there's weather. You might get, you know, hit on a road or something.
Sickness.
May happen.
Yeah.
Or, and there's still, you know, our river otters can still eat them. And our,
yeah.
Something can catch an odd one. But they're... they're pretty much, once you're an adult, you kind of got a ticket to be around a long time.
And that the female that we caught, who was 55, was gravid. She was pregnant.
Oh.
So the thing is, if you graph that out, right, because people are like, how can you have 95% egg and hatchling mortality and still have a population of turtles? Like, that doesn't make sense, right?
Right.
Have a female who's been laying a clutch, the average is like 6.
Mm-hmm.
So she's been laying 6 eggs every year since she was
age 10 to age 45 years.
45 years, yeah.
Boom, 45 years in a row. She's been, that's 45 nests. And
270.
Yeah. So of that, she needs 2 to survive, right?
Right.
Or, well, with male, right? But
right.
So of those 270 eggs laid, right, that's a decent chance that a couple of those are going to survive to be adults.
Right.
So when people are like, we can't have this level of loss when they're really little, well, that doesn't, right? This is a long-lived species. You're not looking, we're not looking at somebody who needs to have replacement within the first 3 years or your population is going to sputter out.
Right. Now, I know one of their big predators is, you know, the invasive bullfrog. When there are these little hatchlings, how do you eat a baby turtle? Is that shell solid or is it edible, basically? In other words, can a bullfrog digest that shell?
Oh, no. There's a couple of records of turtles, Western pond turtles, eaten by bullfrogs. I mean, they're in the guts, and also bass will eat them, or about anything can eat them. They're pretty, they're only the size of a quarter when they hatch out. They're pretty dinky. Bullfrogs can eat things.
Bullfrogs will eat ducklings.
They'll eat anything they put in their mouth, and they've got a big mouth. No, they can eat them and digest them.
That shell digests?
Yeah.
It does. Yeah. Oh, that's unfortunate.
I will say that there are places where there are very large, very successful populations of Western pond turtles,
uh-huh.
where there are also very, very large populations of American bullfrogs,
uh-huh.
and they do not seem to be having an impact on them in those populations.
Yeah, now, that's argued back and forth, but a lot of people say the bullfrogs wiping out the Western pond turtle. Now, the bullfrogs are predator, but there are other predators too. And it does have an impact, and it reduces recruitment, but the pond turtles can still persist. And we don't know how all this happens. You know, there's a lot of things we don't know, but there's, as Gwen suggested, there's some really large turtle populations, like in, especially in the Central Valley of California, and bullfrogs have been there for 100 years. But a colleague of mine down by Bakersfield, he has one area he's been trapping, and he's trapped 600 turtles. Mm-hmm. And there's recruitment. There's little turtles in there, and there's bullfrogs everywhere. So you have these things that don't add up. You have But it's kind of like a trade-off. The bullfrogs eat the young, but they're not totally stopping the having a large population.
Okay.
And it varies, you know, it depends where you are. You can, they're not doing the turtles any good. That's, you know, but they're take a proportion of the young, but they aren't extirpating the turtle. So
the other thing about that is that prior to European colonization, there were large native frogs on the West. So it's not that the Western like pond turtle like evolved someplace where there were no frog predators. There were large frogs here before. Whether they ate Western pond turtles, we have no idea. We can't make those statements. But they did share ponds with frogs before this. So,
and predatory fish, like I know in California, there's the pike minnow, and they get up to like 3 feet long or bigger, and they're voracious predator. And I've seen them down in Northern California. They take, there's something in the water, they hit it. They're like a pike. But the turtles are real abundant there, but they had a native large predatory fish. And there's also red-legged frogs that get pretty big and other predators. So the turtle has lots of predators on it, and bullfrogs one of them. But I think, but again, I think you have to make it place-based. Like, where are you? I mean, if you're in an isolated pond and you only had 10 turtles in it, you know, maybe and a lot of bullfrogs, the turtles are probably going to suffer from that. They're not going to get, you know, do too well. But in other places, there's an isolated pond down near Medford, where Simon Ray, who then worked for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, marked turtles, and there's like 400 turtles in like this two-acre pond. I've never seen so many turtles. And one day we are there, we're looking around, and he counted them. There are 110 heads of turtles up looking at you. And that one didn't have bullfrogs until recently, but these turtles reach really high numbers, and sometimes there are bullfrogs around. So it's not an easy thing. It's, you know, it kind of depends where you're, and it might depend on the other predators too, you know, but there's also a compensatory thing. If the bullfrogs maybe take out 20% of the turtles, that means they're harder to find for the bullfrog too.
Right. Right.
Those hatchlings that stay hidden in the shallows away from the bullfrogs are out usually a little bit. And so again, it's complicated, and we need further study, but a lot of it is.
Yeah. That's not settled science.
Yeah. We need to be less accusatory. It's happening, but the evidence isn't here yet.
Well, what is the status of the Western pond turtle?
Regulatory, it's listed by the state of Washington, they consider it endangered. Within the Oregon, California, it's a species of concern. You can't buy and sell them. You can't collect them. Or whatnot, and they're protected in Mexico. I can't rattle off what that is, but they're protected by every state. But the biggest thing is, which is happening right now, is the Western pond turtle is proposed for federal listing as a threatened species. And the comment period just closed, but kind of rumors has that the comment period may open up again. And I heard like there's 6,000 comments have been submitted, and Fish and Wildlife will read all those comments and then proceed and approximately make a decision about a year from now. There's been a lot of meetings. I sat in on a couple of big Zoom meetings, like 100 people, and each meeting talking about the turtle. And they've done a lot of modeling and other things, but they've been reviewing it for over a year, but it's moving along. It's possible that it might get listed, and the turtle has been split up. It used to be one species. It's now two, kind of a northern one north of San Francisco, and then there's a southern one. Most likely the southern one is most endangered or threatened, because if you live in LA, there's not a lot of natural water. It's just humans. And also, when you get down there, water's scarce. I mean, that's it. And then there's battles over every drop of water. But as you go south, you have less and less water and more humans. So that's a toxic combination for an aquatic animal like the turtle. Up here, we have more water, fewer people. And to me, in the core area, kind of like from the Umpqua Basin down to almost down to San Francisco is the core. In my opinion, they're doing relatively well. They need some protection, but again, it's complicated, you know, and I don't know what the Fish and Wildlife will do. They can list populations, but I don't know where they're going on it. I'm not running that show. I'm an observer like everybody else.
So what is the threat? Is habitat their primary threat?
Well, urbanization. The turtle usually doesn't do very well in urban areas. Partly, I suspect, is this turtle tends to go on land. They do move around. And if you move, that's death because of the roadways.
Right.
Roads, a lot of them die in roads. And just like you said, habitat loss. Most of the agriculture areas, both the Willamette Valley and the Central Valley down in California, were prime turtle habitat. A lot of oxbows, backwaters, which are really good for turtles, but a lot of that's been drained for agricultural fields. And the other one is any place, as I said, any place you got water, you got humans. Where do you go and try to find water at lower elevations where people haven't been there? And we dam it up, we irrigate it, we put it water in canals. We've had major impact on the natural water flows in the West.
So that's, I mean, as Bruce said, habitat loss, human interactions. Although there are scattered Western pond turtles who do things like live in the city park or like right next to the Fred Meyer.
Right.
Most of them avoid areas where there's a lot of human traffic. Even just foot traffic will chase them away from their basking sites, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if there's too many humans around, you generally find far fewer pond turtles. And we don't necessarily know the mechanism of that. But as Bruce said, it's probably roads, draining of water bodies. Bruce was saying, well, they dam the river up. And this part we don't know super well. We don't really know the effects of dams on Western pond turtles, but we don't find them being very abundant in deep, cold water.
Okay.
And in the West, we've pretty much put all the water in a place where it's deep and cold.
Uh-huh.
Right? And we do still find Western pond turtles living in reservoirs, but they're often living in like the arm of a reservoir,
mm-hmm.
or in a like a quiet, small river that's an input to the reservoir. So if you're looking at like areas of habitat for Western pond turtle, you're like, but there's a giant lake here. They're living in the middle of that giant, deep, cold lake. That's not where turtles live. Turtles live in, Western pond turtles specifically live in nice, warm, shallow spots with lots of sticks.
Yeah.
And they're not a big river turtle either. Like they're in the Umpqua Valley. I mean, the Umpqua River has turtles, but they're just, you know, kind of low numbers. They're along the edges, but they aren't particularly abundant. They're usually more abundant like in a pond, maybe on an alluvial plain next to the river or a backwater, you know. They do move up and down rivers, but they're not a deep water turtle. I mean, the Umpqua is gigantic, but they're not.
Right.
There are relatively few turtles in the main stem. They're there, but not a heck of a lot of them. But they do add up. But then you do have these pockets. And part of that, too, is in those areas you get, they really are real important to have cover. We haven't mentioned that yet, but like a boulder pile or a logs. The turtles really hide. They spend a lot of their under the water hidden. So if you don't have cover, you're usually not going to have too many turtles. But the other one is you can't get a false sense of security. Like if you're in Roseburg, and Gwen mentioned, go to Freddie Meyer's, and right next door, there's the duck pond.
Right.
There's turtles galore in there. But it's relatively unscathed because there's the VA hospital next door and grassy areas and a lot of blackberries around. But most of that is protected habitat around the pond. So the turtles have areas to get out and roam around and also for nesting areas. So they do, there's a lot of turtles there, but part of it is you're right in the core area. And people in Roseburg go, oh, they're common. Well, yeah, they're common there and around the Umpqua Basin, but you go out of the Umpqua and Rogue, the turtles are really, less common. So count your lucky stars.
Right.
There are a lot of turtles where you are, but don't, it's not that when you go south of San Francisco, you go and you can find maybe 20 turtles a day around the Umpqua River. But if you get out of that core area, the turtles are actually quite low.
And as Bruce mentioned, so it's not just the water that has to be protected for there to be Western pond turtles there. And more than half of the year on land, depending on what's where they live and what's going on. So some of them are spending more time on land than in the water.
What
And
are
if
they doing on the land? Why would a turtle be on the land?
they are hibernating or estivating.
Or do we
So
say brumation?
sure.
Okay.
Sure. You're right, that is more specific to reptiles. So I'm differentiating between hibernation and estivation specifically because one is when it is cold and the other is when it is too hot.
Okay, tell me about those, please. Tell me the
So
difference.
yes. So in the winter, Western pond turtles are inactive.
Right.
Although it's a lovely sunny day today, and so they may have popped up and be basking right now. But generally, if you go out this time of year, you're not going to find any turtles at all. They apparently don't exist. And that is because they are hibernating somewhere. And they can, if they live in a pond system that does not get violent floods, then they're most likely to have sunk themselves down in the mud in the bottom of their
Okay.
pond. If they are in a system where floods are a big moving flood is a danger, then they are going to be estivating in the hills above the flood line.
Okay.
Because, right, evolutionarily, if you stayed in the river and then the big flood came, well, you didn't have any descendants.
Great.
So those that live in, like, if they live in the Rogue River, for example, they're not going to be down in the mud in the Rogue River. There isn't any, but so those are going to be hibernating up in the hills. The flip side of that is that because they're highly adapted for Mediterranean climates where we have no precipitation in the hottest months or very little precipitation, they've also evolved the capability to themselves to a place where it's cool enough for them to survive, kind of shut everything down when it's too hot.
Okay.
So they were in the pond is starting to dry up, right? It's a bazillion degrees, and they're like, nope, no thank you. I am done with all of whatever this is. And they can again sink themselves down into the mud or get out, go up into the forest, and then dig down into the dirt, which is much cooler
Okay.
than on the surface, right, where you're getting all the rays of the sun on your person and
Great.
pretty low, and dig themselves down and estivate during the hottest months. So
Okay.
they, for example, they generally lay their eggs at the beginning of the summer, so then they could build up a bunch of body fat, estivate for a while, and then come out when it's not a bazillion degrees.
Great. Okay. Because I had always heard that if a turtle's on the land in general, and mostly actually speaking of snapping turtles, it's either sick or it's a female looking to nest. And so that you leave it alone because either way, they don't want to be bugged. Like she's either, but does that mean they're sick? But not necessarily. They may be looking for just better habitat.
Yep. And occasionally we will hear about somebody. We heard this story in Southern Oregon. Someone was driving on a logging road in the middle of nowhere with no visible water around, and there was a Western pond turtle along. And they're like, what are you doing here? Like, what is going on. But yeah, Bruce can tell you stories. They will also, because some populations of turtles have like radio trackers on them.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally pond will start to dry up and they'll just take off. They're like, nope, I'm out. I'm going to like go find water over here. Western pond turtles rely not only on a suitable water habitat, but also connected extensive land habitat around that water. So yeah, we have a pond here locally that we know had Western pond turtles in it in the past, but now is essentially surrounded by roads and
right.
pond turtles.
Okay, that makes sense. Are there any symbiotic relationships or dependencies between these turtles and other members in their ecosystem that their absence kind of messes things up?
No, it's probably, I'm not too sure about symbiotic. That means kind of helps the host and something else.
Right.
But the turtles occasionally, and it happens up here, they have an algae on them, which is, turns out there's an algae. It mostly grows on turtles. And we wrote that up. We got an expert back east on it. But the turtles, there are certain algae that do better on turtle shells or are specialized for some darn reason. But occasionally you will find turtles with algae on them. And usually they're in ponds. So I haven't found it in the river ones. It's not the case. And it can get really impressive. I mean, really. Yeah,
they look like they have a giant head of hair.
Yeah. But that's not, so much symbiotic, but I can't think.
Well, is that good or bad? Is that good or bad, that algae? Do we want that or not?
We're doing fine.
Care. Yeah. We were also really startled. It's
kind of rare, actually.
Yeah, it's rare. We just went out to this one pond and pulled out really fuzzy turtles and whatever is going on here. And we sent in the sample and the sample came back as this specialized green filamentous algae that grows on turtle shells.
How cool.
Apparently we have turtles with like a giant hairdo now. Delightful.
And I can't sort them out, but some turtles, well, the Western pond turtle differs. Like there's also the introduced slider. Sliders will actually shed the outer layers. So some turtles actually shed annually, and that could be a response to all the surface algae or other things. But Western pond turtles don't do that. So
Okay. They're
probably susceptible to this algae more because of that. But other symbiotic ones, I can't think of anything off the top of my head.
Let's talk about the eggs. Is that a rumor? Does the temperature affect the eggs or the sex of the babies?
Yeah, there's some really good work. It was done actually some earlier down actually in the Klamath Lake area. The scientists came out and he got some eggs and he took them back and incubated them. And which actually was shocking, was a couple of decades ago, but the temperature in the nest will determine the sex of the turtle later when they hatch. So it turns out that if the nest is warm above 29°C, which is, I'm trying to convert that to about 80 Fahrenheit or something.
Mm-hmm.
If it's high temperature above about 80 Fahrenheit, they are increasingly female.
Uh-huh.
So it kind of depends on the nest. And some more recent work's being done down at Cal State Sonoma by Nick Geist, who went to Oregon State. He's a paleontologist, but him and a lot of his students are working on turtles. They're doing great stuff, and they're looking into that. But again, when the nest warms up, if you get up around 29°C, about
84 degrees,
okay, about 85 Fahrenheit, if the nest gets up to that, it increasingly has females. So it kind of depends, and it gets more complicated than that. I can't even summarize it all, but where the female puts the nest can actually determine the outcome. Are they going to be males or more females? And there's slight differences within the nest, top of the nest, bottom of the nest. And if a nest turns out to be in the shade of a tree, can even make a difference. It really, there's a lot of things. But these turtles tend to nest in the open. And in some areas that I can't believe they can put nests in, some hard
They're very good at
soil.
digging.
But they once they get going, they put, they
No.
put eggs. They dig a hole. It's like an inverted light bulb. Get down there and they just excavate it, put the eggs in, and then they dig the dirt back and tamp it down, and it forms a plug. And then the eggs are basically inside a chamber. As far as we know, and we need a lot more on this because it's not proven, but it appears that most of the nests up here overwinter.
The babies stay in the
Yep,
nest.
they're inside that nest, and when they hatch, that's the part I've been trying to look into. I haven't as they hatch out eventually, but they're still in the nest, and then they wait until the winter rains and temperature goes up, but they come out starting the next March. So they're in
March,
the
okay.
for that entire time. And then the soil gets pliable enough, and then they dig out and head out. And that's, to me, an adaptation for a Mediterranean climate. Because if you're in your nest, they nest in mid-June's the peak. And then if you come out and say the end of September, a lot of places in the Mediterranean, the hatchling comes out, you're the size of a quarter. You
Right.
don't have a lot of resource. I mean, you just,
Right.
just used up your egg yolk. They have an egg yolk, and then they have to come out and find water, and water may not be there. So a lot of those may have died. So in fact, by being basically trapped in your nest, when you come out, it's wet. All you just open your mouth, and there's probably water on a
Warm.
leaf,
Right. Good point.
and then you can, and it's cool in September. It's not going to be hot as Hades, and I mean, there's probably very high mortality on those that come out in the fall. But again, this hasn't been documented too well.
So, and the other thing is, they may not be able to get out in September. Again, they're like they hatch at the size of a quarter.
Yeah,
So, and their
they're
mom has dug a pretty,
deep.
pretty deep hole to seal them up in to keep them safe.
Yeah.
And so, somebody the size of a quarter having to dig out of the hole that the mom made for them, they may not be able to get out when the soil is that hard. They
It's just
will.
not strong enough. Okay.
Right. You have to wait until the soil softens, and it would be a bad evolutionary idea to come in flood season when you're the size of a quarter, right?
Yeah.
And we were also talking about, right, so all of the adults, by the time the soil has softened, all of the adults have are going to go and dig themselves a nice place to hibernate for the winter. And the little baby the size of a quarter is not really good at digging themselves a nice hole that's deep enough to keep them safe. So their mom has essentially pre-dug them a place where they can hibernate over the winter.
Okay, that makes sense.
Right? So, yeah, there's a whole lot of reasons that their nests are like shaped the way they are, located where they are, et cetera. But it is not a rumor. Yes, the temperature inside the nest does determine the sex of the adult turtle.
Which, of course, leads us to the question, of course, of global warming. Are we going to lose our turtles because we only have females?
So there's a couple of things there. This is temperature inside of the nest, buried in the ground. So soil temperature changes slower than air temperature. That's one thing. Are there risks from climate change? Definitely yes, right? You've got fires, you've got floods, you've got extreme weather events, you've got heat domes and ice storms and all kinds of stuff that definitely can harm turtles, right?
And their pond disappearing by the time they hatch in September.
Yep. Drought, humans moving around, all kinds of things about climate change and human use of resources definitely are dangers to Western pond turtles. The thing is that the temperature in the nest increasing leads to more females. So you would have to get to the point that there were no males in your population for that to be a disadvantage.
Okay.
That
Okay.
would
You're right. Okay. Because we need we just need basically one male and then several females.
Right. So more, so in species that hotter means more males, you have way more of a problem.
Okay, gotcha.
Where hotter means more females. So in this case, Western pond turtles are lucky.
Yeah.
In that it is getting warmer. And again, because it's year to year, right? You need, like, if it's a really hot year, you may have a whole bunch of females that year. But climate change doesn't mean every year is a hot year, just more years are hot years. So if you have one cool year and you get a bunch of males, your population is going to have males for a while. So yes.
Okay. No, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah. So then do the adults nest or do they winter at the bottom of the pond or on the ground? I know our paintants will overwinter at the bottom of the pond, which then freeze, and then they do butt breathing, as we call it, or colloquial respiration, to survive, you know, underwater for the winter. What about the turtles out here? Do they?
We have a friend who has a population that are radio tagged, and he's actually found them moving under the ice. So it depends on whether this is a flood area or not. If it's gonna flood super big, then they're gonna overwinter up away from the water. If it is not an area that floods, like a pond or a lake, then they will overwinter in the mud at the bottom of the pond or lake.
Okay.
Because the Pacific Northwest doesn't usually solid freeze, and because they're not fully hibernating where they're sort of deeply unconscious.
Right.
They will, if there's a warm, sunny day. So today it is warm and sunny up here in Corvallis. And the turtles may come out of hibernation, come up to the surface, get a breath of air, bask for a while, warm themselves up, and then go back down. So you'll occasionally see them just like out and about in the middle of the winter when we have a warm, sunny day. Or they may stay, some in the Klamath, right, might be frozen in their pond all winter.
Okay. All right. So if I see a turtle at Myers, is it going to be a wood turtle or is it going to be a red air slider, or do they have any competition from other turtles?
There is definitely competition between Western pond turtles and the invasive turtles.
Which is a red ear.
Not just the red ear sliders, though. There's other invasives. But yes, where you are, it'll be sliders. Mostly you need binoculars to easily tell them apart, although there are a few other field signs. Sliders can get much larger than Western pond turtles, and they have a taller, blockier shell. Western pond turtles are quite flat. Again, this is like a trained eye thing, but you're like looking out over the pond, you're like, oh yeah, that turtle is very tall. Their shell is very tall. That's going to be a slider.
All right, good. That's something I should be able to notice. Do we have any snappers here now?
They're around. They're for some reason, they're scattered all over Oregon. They've kind of been under the radar because one, snapping turtles, again, another introduced species, but they're pretty much fully aquatic. So people don't see them up on the surface, just very rare. Sometimes a female snapper will come up and bask, but they'll be on ponds and they don't even know it, but there are records all over, snappers around, but they're very rare.
Yeah.
So this is another problem heading, one we need to nip in the bud. They're easier to control than like with bullfrogs, because if you take a snapper out, they're slow growing, and that's one species we probably could control. And you can trap them out, but you need big turtle traps, because they're big turtles. But those need to be removed out of the system because they're doing nobody any good.
Well, guys, this has been fascinating. I thank you guys so much for your time. This is really cool. Let me remind our listeners, this has been an episode of Living Downstream, and I'm your host, Julie Lowe. I've been speaking with Bruce and Gwen Burry about the Western pond turtle. If you dropped in late or missed any part of this interview or any other interview in our series, you can find past episodes at umpquawatersheds.org. And thank you for listening.